stage management is howling her cue from the wings. I'm there thinking, what are we to do? She goes completely up on her line.
She would do that.
And then James whispers to her, forget it, dearie. It's a matinee audience. They don't even have their earpieces in.
Hey.
So many possible worlds, but we got this one. So many possible worlds, but we got this one.
Welcome to the Worst of All Possible Worlds, the first and only podcast that's got all of these funny theatrical anecdotes for all your funny theatrical anecdote needs. I'm the worst of all possible Brians.
I'm the worst of all possible AJs.
And I'm the worst of all possible Joshes.
And we are joined here today by Graham Teckler, a guy who previously appeared on this show many years ago when Stephen Sondheim was freshly dead.
In our saddest episode I think we've ever recorded. We're all on the verge of tears for most of it. So we're so excited to have you back.
It was such a horrible tragedy that a 90-year-old man might pass away.
That was a devastating conversation, and I'm very happy to be back here under happier circumstances. So thank you for having me.
You are here to talk to us not about your illustrious work in the theater as an actor, as a playwright, as a contributor to The New Yorker.
Not
a theatrical thing, but it's also a thing that you do.
It's true.
He's very funny, folks. You've probably read one of his articles. You may not even realize.
We're going to link so many of them in the description.
But you've joined us to talk about the hit Canadian television show, the hot new thing that all the Zoomers are buzzing about. The 2005 classic from Acorn Media, Slings and Arrows, season two.
When did you do your episode on the first season?
One year ago.
Pretty much exactly a year ago.
And I believe I just slid. I was a real reply guy about it. I was just like, if you are, I am not normally someone who's like, I want to be in your podcast. You know, get me on there because people got their own thing going on. You don't want to.
Yeah,
like,
with the Sondheim thing, I was like, oh, it'd be fun to have a guest. You know, Graham is great. Let me call him up.
I don't ever want to be like, oh, we kind of have a plan for that, and then you're like imposing your friendship on people. I was like, guys, please let me talk about this.
You threatened our careers.
You were really angry.
The next available opportunity that Slings and Arrows is being discussed.
And then we waited like 14 months to do the next.
But we do. It's a nice yearly tradition. I really dig this. But it was specifically you wanted to talk about season two, which I think is a very, very fascinating season of television.
In my opinion, the best season out of the three.
My
favorite.
I think it hits higher highs, but I also think it hits lower lows.
I'm with you on that. It has some of my, if not my favorite stuff in the entire show, but I do think it's the most angular and weird season to talk about, and that's why I particularly want
it. It's a very difficult play to stage effectively.
Well, he says over and over and over,
as AJ and I have said over and over and over on this podcast,
much to the bewilderment of Josh.
Hey, I'm just along for the ride on this one, boys.
I
should say though, before we get into talking about this season, if you're interested in hearing more about Slings and Arrows, we did do that episode last year. Would recommend you go check it out. We go in depth in that episode into a lot of stuff about like how this show got made and who the different people were who made it happen and what that looked like. Right. We're not really going to be touching on that today, though, because, I mean, we've already done that backstory.
We're continuing the story, folks.
Exactly.
Yeah, just like the show.
The basic points, there is a theater festival in Canada that is not called Stratford, but it's Stratford. It's called the New Burbage Festival. You have this guy, Jeffrey Tennant. He went insane doing Hamlet. And then he came back and he directed a movie star who is not Keanu Reeves in Hamlet. You have Ellen Fanshawe, who is his ex, who is also sort of the aging actress who has done a lot of the work and is kind of losing on the roles that she could be doing at this point because Shakespeare starts to just run out of women.
She's a bit of a diva. She exists in many ways as a foil to Jeffrey. And so they sort of have a combustible relationship, shall we say.
You have Oliver, who is played by Stephen Wimmett of television's Beetlejuice. And
the cartoon he played.
an old gay director who gets run over by a pork truck and is a ghost now.
Canada's finest hams.
That's you right. also have Mark McKinney as Richard Smith Jones, a man as bland as both of those last names, running the theater festival and also co-writing the show.
Wait, wait. Richard with three names? Perhaps some sort of Richard the Third?
That is a stretch.
Yeah, I don't know about that one.
Okay. Here's the thing.
I'll write that out. Okay. But Graham,
So I also want to plug your episode on the first season, which I just listened to.
Thank you for plugging our show on your show.
Yeah, dude,
as a non-co-host of this podcast, as a listener, I can speak to the listener and the psychology of the listener and say, you will really enjoy the episode. It's a lot of fun. I had, to my shame, I hadn't picked up on the broad connections between the plays and the plot of Slings and Arrows.
Yeah.
I don't think I had noticed how specific they get when you were all describing, like, oh, this, you know, beat in the first season is this specific beat in Hamlet, and that had somehow I've seen the show like four or five times at this point, had missed the finer points there and had only been picking up on the very broad stuff, and which I think is kind of to the show's credit that it doesn't
it's not so obvious.
I'm not just saying that to make myself not escape sounding like a dumbass for not picking up on it, but
well, the fucking chameleon thing that Brian brought up, that there's an actual chameleon,
the chameleon dish I eat
that,
it's
that
the
kind
air
of thing
hot served.
Sorry for not picking up on the chameleon's dish.
I mean, sorry, everyone. Fuck.
But I would not put it past them to be slipping in the three named Richard thing. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing about this second season was Slings and Arrows was only supposed to be one season. Yeah, it was supposed to be a one and done thing.
They had an idea sketched out for what a like sort of a three season arc would be.
Right.
But that was high hopes for a living.
Yes.
You can't do that anymore.
No, inflation. Mama said I could.
No, inflation, man. It's not.
This is us coming out of supporting the Buttigieg bid for the presidency this year.
Yeah.
I'm doing the
dance. From behind,
I'm doing the dance right now. You can't see it.
Graham is actually doing the dance.
I tried it and I forgot what it was.
It is very funny because, Graham, we listed all of your credits, but we failed to mention that you were a speechwriter for Buttigieg during that whole campaign.
I didn't want to bring, I didn't feel like a safe place to bring up my time, my successful tenure.
It was a shame he cut all your jokes. I feel like that would have really helped.
Graham was actually the guy who like pulled the fuse box and
turned off all the lights in that gymnasium. Yeah,
it's a shame because he's such a funny guy and he's just got that like crackerjack timing. And it's a shame that he wouldn't let us play to that forte. You know,
sorry. I personally,
he's doing great work as Secretary of Transportation.
He's the choo-choo man.
Yeah.
He makes the trains go choo-choo.
He makes the trains stop going choo-choo.
For the 2028
apparently.
Election. The highest of hopes.
Yeah. The show was like surprisingly successful after that first season, and it got three seasons. But it's not a very successful show. It's a cult hit. People buy the DVDs and stuff in the States and everything, but like it was a much bigger hit when it got remade in Brazil. What we start with here at the beginning of season two is continuing a structure that they developed in the first season, right? The pilot of season one is its own contained story, but it connects into what the rest of the season is going to be. Season two starts with what is essentially an epilogue to season one.
Right.
Right.
And mostly this is because they are figuring out a way to get rid of Rachel McAdams because she became extremely famous.
Yeah. have you ever heard of the film Mean Girls? That came out, I think, the same year this season
Mean
did?
Girls and The Notebook came out the exact same year as season one of Slings and Arrows.
It's honestly incredible that Rachel McAdams didn't, like, die on the way back to her home planet.
That they were able to get her back. You can tell it must have been a tight schedule because it's just, like, her and...
Lou Kirby.
Yeah, and Ellen. It's just the three of them, basically, in all of the scenes. I think Jeffrey interacts with her, but, like, it's really tight.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like really hanging out with the rest of the crowd, but it's done very elegantly. It doesn't feel like a COVID production the way that they do it.
Right. Totally. There's no blue screen like Jeffrey in the background saying goodbye, you know.
It contrasted interestingly for me with, I don't know if you've ever seen Party Down, but like at the very last episode of the new season of Party Down, they brought back Lizzie Kaplan. Surprise.
Ooh, okay.
Spoiler alerts for season three of Party Down, I guess. But
yeah.
That was one where they very clearly were like, okay, we have her for like an hour. Let's try to do something.
Yeah.
And I was so impressed with this, with Slings and Arrows, how they were able to get Rachel McAdams back in, incorporate her into the storytelling in a way that felt like durable and lasting. And it wasn't just, oh, we got to get rid of her now. And I think it set us up well going into the rest of the season, because of course in season two, there's also an ingenue who we end up getting. So the handoff was done really nicely. I thought this was mechanically very elegant.
I think in the past, I used to see this as like, if not a liability then to the season, then at least a bit more of like a perfunctory element of the season, where it's like the show has the opposite problem that the show has in reality, which is like narratively and production wise, they have the opposite problem. The production problem is that Rachel McAdams is the actress is too famous to continue being on this show. And narratively, the Luke Kirby character is too famous to plausibly continue being at this festival.
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of like, I think watching it this time, it was a lot more elegantly done than I remembered it somehow.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. If you're just going into it, you're not necessarily thinking about the time that the show is being made or when each season is being filmed. You're like, well, okay, that character's gone now.
But I do think it's a coda on the showman's arc that that needs to be there that couldn't have possibly been done in season one.
Yeah.
Given where that story ends.
And it gives Ellen this great moment where she has sacrificed everything in her life, her relationships and everything, to be an actor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And being a woman in a Shakespeare festival means that everything dries up by the time you're 40.
Well, because she goes from playing Ophelia to 7 years later playing Gertrude, which is
crazy.
Like, that's an absurd turnaround time.
And then she's like, and then what? You're like the nurse. We get this great moment of clarity from her where she goes to Rachel McAdams. She's like, get the fuck out of here. Who cares if this relationship with Jack Crew lasts? Who cares? Maybe it's going to fall apart in a couple weeks, but what business do you really have to do around here? Everything is always going to be a risk. You're an actor.
Yeah, and it's lovely. And I actually think it's to Rachel McAdams' great credit that she came back to do this at all.
Yeah.
She was so famous at this point, she did not have to, like, by any means come back to finish off this arc. But she did, and she stayed for the whole episode. And it's actually a lot more substantial a role than I was expecting for, like, a goodbye thing. Like, she actually has, like, huge moments.
A number of
and
scenes,
Yeah, and she's so winning and so charming. The only thing that I think this kind of shoots the show in the foot for going forward is that the new ingenue that comes in is just not Rachel McAdams.
Yeah.
And that's
not
that actor's fault. I think she does a good job with it, but like, how do you compare?
And it becomes even clearer in season three that they had planned an arc for that character.
Oh, sure.
That would progress through season three.
Oh,
and that's also why Sarah Polley's character is drawn so like caustically from the very beginning. You're like, I don't know if I really like this person.
That's interesting. Right.
But it makes sense if you think about that arc being from season one to the end. But they kind of stay the course with just a different ingenue each season. So we're at the last performance of Hamlet. It's the end of the season. It's all of these high school groups that are coming in and throwing pennies at them.
It's a wonderful commentary on how art that runs long enough, or a theater show that runs long enough, eventually becomes a parody of itself.
Yeah.
Like Jeffrey is running around backstage giving people notes. And I just want to call this out for a little bit.
This is the last performance. This is a matinee that's closing out the season, and the director of the show is still giving everyone notes in between scenes.
In front of a bunch of students who are throwing pennies at the stage.
Directors don't do this. Just don't do this. I mean, there's equity rules against it. Like directors are not allowed to actually do that after a certain point. But this is also the beginning of us re-examining Jeffrey as a character, whereas in season one he was mad, but he was also
he was so smart.
Mm-hmm. He was so smart, and he was going to be the big strong man to come in and fix the play.
The only
and,
person
like, bring
like, thinking
back.
Outside the box. You know, everyone's so stuck in their ways,
that's
and
right.
Now it's like he essentially breaks every rule of directing at a certain point.
But he gets results, damn it.
he does, but I think that what this show is very smart about is that because this is an adaptation of Macbeth, it allows Jeffrey to be more monstrous. Mm. And I think a lot of people, like when I was younger, what I took away was, Jeffrey's right. He has like all these sort of like madcap things, but he gets results. And now that I watch it, it's like, oh no, the show also understands that Jeffrey is behaving quite badly.
Yeah, I think if you look at like the authors of the show and you see the interviews that they've done, they're trying to make him more like anti-heroic, but I think they do kind of fail at depicting him that way.
I agree. Mm. Yeah, I see what they are attempting to do, But this is something that we, I think, talk about on this show quite a bit is like, well, is the finger on the scale a little bit? Mm-hmm. Do they want you to like this guy a little bit too much? And I think in this show, the answer is yes. But I also think this is something that we'll be able to unpack a bit more as we go on and talk about some of the specific things that Jeffrey does. Yeah.
So as we go along with the business side of things, we're here with Richard Smith Jones. He's begging for money from a water bottle company.
I wanted to talk about the water bottle guy, Peter Keligan.
Yeah.
Any of you seen, I know there was a lot of discussion of Aaron Sorkin on the last episode about this show.
Yep.
Have you seen the Canadian newsroom?
There's a Canadian newsroom?
There's a show called The Newsroom. It is completely unrelated. The American newsroom is not an adaptation of it.
Okay.
But it is, it is essentially Canadian Larry Sanders show.
About a newsroom.
A long running show too. And one that I think kind of came back.
Not that many episodes, but
Right, because it's Canadian, they do six-episode seasons.
It's a bit more long-running in the British way of it's like, oh, it's six episodes, but it's been running for 20 years. And it's like, who knows how that works? But it's extremely, extremely good. And similarly to like when I discovered Slings and Arrows as a teenager, that was one where it's like, hey, if you can like, it's in like, every episode's in five parts on YouTube or something, and you can watch it. And it's like, if you're like a sitcom nerd, like this is where you start really digging into.
By the way, you can still watch Slings and Arrows on YouTube
to
this day, but it's just like pixelated shapes.
Yeah,
someone was like, it's AI upscaled, which just looks way worse than if they hadn't touched it at all.
It's also whenever there is any kind of solid black on the screen, it starts like glitching out with like a ghostly circles and stuff, which makes it look like the theater is always haunted whenever they're in it, which it is. So.
Which it is. I mean, to be fair, it's also just Canadian propaganda in the blacks. Yeah. It'll just start being, you know, like loony now.
Well, and this is a great scene where you have this guy who's really abrasive. He's purely like just a scumbag businessman. He talks about the fact that he just sells people water. A thing you can get out of the tap for free.
Yeah.
And he has reprioritized his business. They're like, yeah, your charity, because you fucked up so bad last season by banging someone who was on the board.
Which he did, by the way. We will remember Richard having an ongoing affair with this horrible, horrible woman
named Holly Day,
who was going to turn the whole thing into like a Shakespeare amusement park.
This is a thing that I do love about the second season is that the main victory at the end of season one is like, oh, we've cast this horrible woman out of our kingdom and she's no longer a problem anymore, which is great for the narrative of the scrappy young theater company, you know, sticking it to the corporate man, but does actually cause a huge fucking
problem.
We don't
have any money.
The company's fucking destitute now.
And between that and sort of like triumphant staging of Hamlet, like, well, we finally did it. And like, oh, and the show was great. And we all love each other and it's all great. The natural course of just, at a certain point at the end of the run, you're all kind of sick of each other. You know, you're very tired.
It's a long play.
You got to figure out what to do with your showmance with Keanu Reeves. And it's just like, I like that all of the problems they're facing down at the beginning of this season are natural extensions from their victories at the end of last season. It's not just like, it's not like the thing of like they'll do, I don't want to throw a show I like under the bus, but something like Justified where it's like, oh no. And now there's a new criminal from out of town
who's
here to take over, you know,
24 does that a lot. Yeah. Like, it just smash the reset button basically.
Or like create a new,
the seasonal big bad.
The seasonal big bad, which they do that
in the form of casting,
and from a different angle. So it's not just like a water bottle guy from the newsroom is there to replace Holly as the money man.
Yeah, Richard doesn't
antagonist.
Fuck the water bottle guy.
No,
he's
actually like the secondary protagonist of this season.
Water bottle guy is a guy who actually cares about the business side of things, sees how incompetent Richard is, and is like, "Look, you're on the ropes, man. You either shape up or ship out." And I'm going to be happy to go along with this. And it's fun to watch Richard flounder. I mean, it's fun to watch the Kids in the Hall's own Mark McKinney.
Yeah. He's just so
talking about like
funny
how much he hates the Paralympics.
And it is funny also just watching Richard once again be cucked. If you start like grafting on Macbeth to this season, it gets very complicated very quickly. There's so many subplots in this season that it gets to the point where I can't even keep track of most of them.
Yeah, no, they're being a little bit more free with this.
It's also, it almost seems like maybe the creators don't necessarily like the play of Macbeth very much. Like,
I don't think I agree with that, but okay, let's follow this.
I think it's more just about the amount of times that Jeffrey's like, it's a very difficult play to stage effectively, and then a lot of this thing is like debating the merits of Macbeth's a play. Is it a action slasher movie, or is it the story of one man's descent into madness and violence and like how evil affects us? And it's not like with Hamlet where they were going into it with like, this is a great play that just needs to be revealed as great. This is actually a season about people being like, how do we make Macbeth work?
They're treating Macbeth like it's a problem play in the Shakespearean sense of the term, which I think
it kind of is.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Infamously, the second half is just weird.
and there is, of course, and we will talk about this more, famously a curse on the play itself. Yeah. You know, and people who are superstitious will tell you don't say fucking Macbeth in a theater, because the moment that you do, something bad is going to happen.
Yeah. In prep for this episode, people kept asking me what we were covering this week for the podcast. And I was in a theater and I said, oh, we're doing Six and Arrows season 2. And they're like, oh, what's the play they did for that? And I said Macbeth, and they would make me go outside every time. They would trap me in it, so I would spin around and spit over my shoulder.
Yeah, and you have
whatever.
To be invited back in like a vampire. And yeah.
Well, you know, there is also the rumor that Macbeth is cursed because it uses like actual like witch incantations in the double toil and trouble which we also used in the play that we just closed. And so everyone was like, well, is this play
quotations,
also cursed?
Quotations from Macbeth are also supposed to be like bad news. You don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we love the theater. We love our superstitions. We love our healing crystals.
We love our not whistling in the theater so you're not crushed by scenery.
Yeah. I mean, that's important.
But going into Macbeth, of course, Hamlet had a ghost. Season 1 of Slings and Arrows had a ghost. Macbeth has witches.
Yes.
Mm. Witches.
A.K.A. decrepit old subscribers who are allowed to come backstage to hang out with people after the show.
She must have a lot of money.
Question mark? Yeah. She must be a donor.
So we have, you know, and the witches, there are three. Witches three. The strange, the weird sisters. And here we have Moira, which is, of course, the name for a Greek sister of fate, the Moirai. A singular Moira. So Moira shows up. She's a very witchy lady, very wrinkly and, you know, dressed with like a wrap around her head and everything, and talking in cryptic tones about what the season may portend. Because Macbeth is not on the, they're not going to do Macbeth.
But she's sort
season.
Of talking about it as if it is.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Yeah. You know, and putting it in, and Jeffrey immediately. So is the metaphor here that she is putting like kingly ambition in his head from that moment on, even though he's saying, I don't want to do it. He kind of can't stop engaging with the idea.
Well, fate intervenes, right? It's not his choice to do Macbeth. It's because they get a big star. Right. And so then the executive director is like, well, who cares about Troilus and Cressida?
Henry Breedlove is just available now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And Henry Breedlove, we find out, is the same actor that
Oliver, the ghost, that he wanted to work with when he was alive.
Yes, exactly.
And Oliver had never done Macbeth. And he has all of these notebooks in a box somewhere about what his vision for Macbeth is going to be.
Boxes and boxes and boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also just want to shout out that the shot where Moira like gives her prophecy about Macbeth happening, it's a very weird shot for
this show. Yes.
It's a very tight close up of just her face. She's staring.
Yeah, they're shooting her on a super long lens. Her face is moving so much. And it looks like she's about to like make the whole frame explode.
I love this about this show that it is 90% shot like a normal television dramedy. Yep. And then every once in a while, they'll just be like, what if we just fucking went crazy for a second?
Yeah. And part of it is that her actual face is so fucking wrinkly.
It's just cool.
She's not even, she's like in her 60s
but
here.
She just is somebody who has a lot of wrinkles.
Yeah, it's great.
The use of that lens and of the framing makes her look like she's 10,000 years old.
She looks like she's in Tilda Swinton old age
And if I can make the scene a little pop a little bit more in your mind, I watched the behind the scenes for this and they're interviewing two of the actors on the show. But you get to see the crew just like setting up shots in the background. Mm-hmm. Bob Martin walks by at one point, one of the co-creators of the show. But most of the crew members are all in like hockey jerseys. So imagine this being shot with just like Gretzky apparel right behind
AJ, they're called hockey sweaters. I'll have you know.
They're not.
They are?
Yeah. Are they?
Wait, do you not know about the best-selling Canadian children's book of all time,
okay, so
The
Josh,
Hockey Sweater?
Nope, Josh, I grew up in a little town called Gallup, New Mexico, and AJ grew up in an even smaller town named San Diego, California. Right. Yeah. We do not fucking know anything about hockey.
AJ, would you mind apologizing really quick?
Apologize to Canada, AJ?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Canada.
No. Say it again.
I'm so sorry, Canada.
That's not how you pronounce that word.
The Hockey
I'm so
Sweater.
Sorry, Canada.
There we go.
The Hockey Sweater, La Chandelle de Hockey in the original French, is a short story by Canadian author Roche Carrier and translated to English by Sheila Fishman.
He's reading from his laptop right now, just so you know.
And basically what you
his eyes have rolled up in the back of his head.
You get this kid,
Josh went into Mentat mode.
He's a fan of the Montreal Canadiens, and then his fucking mom gets him a Toronto Maple Leafs hockey sweater instead.
Wait, I'm sorry. Mm. There is a hockey team that's just called the Canadiens.
Do you seriously not know this?
Seriously? I don't know anything about hockey.
Brian, we're going to need you to apologize now.
Sorry. Fuck. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
Yeah, it's the Montreal Canadiens.
Very good.
Damn.
The Montreal Canadiens have won, I think, 22 Stanley Cups.
Here's a fun fact about San Diego. Our hockey team was so bad, it stopped existing.
I know.
Like our football team.
Listen, I'm just going to wrap up by say this. Fuck the Leafs. Fuck the Habs. Go Wings, baby.
The Canadians too? Do we hate them?
Those the Habs, yeah.
The what's? that is not short for Canadians.
That can't be short
for habitants, which is
The fuck is that?
I don't. If you
habitant, what the fuck?
The inhabitants of Montreal, the Canadians.
This is filth, and I will not allow it on my show.
None of these are jokes.
None of these are in the Bible.
It's Easter, Josh.
Canadian listeners, sound off in the comments.
Christ is rising and you're just pushing him right back in.
I'm sorry.
Wow.
I'm sorry, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
I do know that hockey has intermissions.
Between the periods,
yes.
Do they call them that?
They call them intermissions because they're homos. One of the people that Jeffrey kind of crosses in his constant note giving is Brian.
Alfred.
Me, Brian Alford.
A new character, am I not mistaken?
An old character.
Yeah.
He was on the first
season. But he's played by a different actor, I think, in season one. There's a brief moment where Jeffrey is like doing his flashback to when he did Hamlet.
And you see Claudius is
Brian. He's like, oh yeah, Brian was back there.
Right.
I don't know if this is an intentional reference to longstanding Stratford guy Brian Dennehy. But he sure looks
a lot like Brian Dennehy.
Well, this is Leon Poneall. I'm assuming he also probably had his stint at Stratford because every Canadian actor of prestige tends to float through Stratford at some point.
Sure.
Especially on this show.
Right.
And he actually he passed away a year after this season aired. This was one of the last things he ever did.
To a real one.
Yeah, he was in Dead Poets Society.
I love this character, and I always forget. Every time I watch this show, I see him like, oh, this fucking guy. The famous secondary antagonist of the second season of Slings and Arrows.
Yeah.
And I always forget that there's like a lot more to him and that he plays a much more interesting role in the overall narrative.
Yeah, because here he's the old guy. He's got friends back in his dressing room while the show is going
on.
Like,
he's drinking champagne. Yeah. They want to like basically, you know, they're calling it a wrap.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but much to Jeffrey's chagrin.
Yeah, he's like, why don't you care?
But Brian's right. It's like, dude, you got to let this
thing
go.
They're throwing pennies at us.
Yeah, no. It's also like that Jeffrey doesn't have anything else.
Yeah.
Right? This is all Jeffrey
He doesn't
has.
Have a romantic life. He doesn't even have a ghost hanging around anymore. He's just got Hamlet.
Not yet.
Oh.
And Brian, who has like been essentially a lifer at this festival, has the opposite problem where he has like just a life. He is just living his life, which is good.
It's
everyone should live
a
life and have a job and stuff, but they could not be more far apart from each other ideologically about how to treat
It's sort of like the central conflict of this season becomes this aspect of like being a professional and being an artist. It reminds me of the last season of The Other Two, where he goes onto the set of Law and Order, and it's like a whole Pleasantville situation.
Pleasant, fantastic episode.
Right, yeah. God, it's so good.
It's a brilliant episode.
You could say that the main theme of this season is ambition and what it does. What your relationship to your ambition, artistic or otherwise.
No!
Are you seeing a dagger before you?
Is that a dagger I see before?
No, it's something. A microphone. That's a microphone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's oh. just sort it of dagger. Sharp, though.
Yeah, it's very sharp. I'm bleeding.
Ow, I cut myself on the microphone.
We get this interesting, again, they're trying to get to the anti-hero aspect of this. We get this conversation between Richard and Jeffrey. Richard's all business. Jeffrey is all art. And Richard has to bring him the ugly business thing.
Right. Right.
We have to fire actors. What? We have to do layoffs. We have to downsize because we don't have money. And what does Jeffrey say in response?
Hell yeah, dude.
Fuck yeah. Let's yeah, do
let's
it.
Let's fucking do it. What, this what, Brian guy's pissing me off.
What bloody business is this?
Oh.
Hey there. You are listening to a preview of a premium episode of The Worst of All Possible Worlds. If you'd like to listen to the rest of this, head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/worstofall. And you can listen to not only the rest of this episode, but our entire backlog of premium episodes, bonus episodes, and if you subscribe at the $10 tier, you will get an extra episode of the podcast every single month. Again, that is patreon.com/worstofall. Hope to see you there.